Last week, India's Chandrayaan-3 mission landed a spacecraft on the southern pole of the moon. Here's the reaction in their control room the moment the lander touched down.
जी हाँ, आप अपने स्क्रीन पे देख सकते हैं कि हम लैंडर मॉड्यूल
It's the newest major development in modern space exploration at a time when a mix of government-run and private space programs are aiming for the moon and beyond. The successful landing came just days after a Russian lander crashed in an attempt to do the same thing. Our next guest has been following the latest developments in the international space race, the significance of India's success, and what it all means for the future of space exploration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you excited about space exploration? Do you want to see more American space missions? How about bringing people back to the moon? Now, what questions do you have for our expert on the space industry? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Berger is the senior space editor at Ars Technica. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks very much. Good to talk to you again.
Let's start with this new successful landing from India. How big a deal was this for, I guess, another more recent entry into the quest to land things on places that aren't Earth?
For India, it was a huge deal. You know, they had tried to do this 3 years earlier with a Chandrayaan-2 mission, and they failed because they had some computer issues and that spacecraft crashed into the lunar surface. And so this was their second attempt, and the country had put a lot on this. The leader of the nation, Narendra Modi, has really played up sort of the space ambitions of India and as a point of national pride. And so there was a lot riding on the landing attempt this week. And the other matter is, you know, in Asia, India really sees itself as a competitor with China, and China's spacecraft program is pretty far ahead. They've had several successful lunar landings and actually returned some rocks from the moon a couple of years ago robotically. And so it was really important for India's national pride, I think, for this mission to be a success.
Yeah, I use the phrase space race, and I try to throw little air quotes around it. I mean, are we in a competitive environment where countries and or private industry are trying to hit that next milestone before whoever they perceive their competitors to be?
You know, it's really complicated, but it is accurate, I think, to say we're in a sort of a second generation space race. It's very different from the 1960s when it was just the United States and Soviet Union sort of, you know, marching out into the heavens. Now there are a mix of national players, and it's not just the U.S. and Russia. It's China, India, Europe, Japan, lots of different players. And then you've got commercial companies, you know, like SpaceX and Blue Origin and places like that, that are all really playing in this area and doing interesting things as well. And so there's lots of activity out there.
Now, this is the south pole of the moon. I want to talk about why this seems to be so interesting scientifically, technologically. Why is this part of the moon getting so much attention these days?
Well, it really goes back about 10 or 15 years ago when NASA crashed a probe into the south pole of the moon to basically see if in these permanently shadowed craters there was water ice. And they produced some not definitive but pretty convincing evidence that yes, there is. So these areas of the moon that never see the sun, and so over, you know, billions of years, ice has accumulated there. So there's believed to be legitimately water on the moon. And if you could get water on the moon, that's a pretty handy resource to have. And so you've got all of this activity, particularly from the United States and China, of over the next 5 to 10 years of sending probes to the south pole of the moon, investigating these permanently shadowed regions and seeing if there is really ice there to mine and to be had. And once you have ice, of course, you've got hydrogen fuel, you've got oxygen oxidizer, you can also breathe it, you can also drink the water, make it potable. So it's a pretty handy resource to have in place there. And so, you know, the Indian probe didn't quite make it to the South Pole. It was about 70 degrees south, so about kind of the northern edge of Sweden, in reference to the North Pole here on Earth. But it is certainly the closest that any probe has gotten so far to the South Pole.
And I read somewhere, I think, that Eric, the South Pole itself is a tough place to land a probe. It's rough ground. It is a challenge to get something much closer to the pole. Is that right?
Yeah, both from an energy standpoint, in terms of trying to get a spacecraft there, it is easier to go to these equatorial regions that we saw the Apollo missions go to and some of these other spacecraft. And the South Pole and the North Pole, for that matter, are a little bit more difficult, as you say, because the lighting conditions are difficult, a little more challenging to work with, and the terrain appears to be a little bit more uneven, especially you don't really want to land on the edge of a crater, right? You'd mm-hmm. much rather have these smoother, flatter areas.
Talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at the latest news from space, efforts to land probes on the moon, one from India successful, one from Russia not. And we'll look at what's going on in the United States as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest. Do you have a goal in mind that you'd like to see? Private companies, governments, whatever aiming for, join in at 800-642-1234. Eric, you wrote a piece about the Russian space program, the crash of their latest probe and a decline. You know, they inherited the Soviet era space program, one of the only two games in town for a long time. What has gone wrong there as you see it?
Well, you know, the Soviets had a very inventive and extraordinary space program in the 1960s and 70s. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, they really stopped innovating and putting substantial funding in. So they're basically flying the same vehicles that were developed in the 1960s and 70s. They're very good, right, at what they do for human spaceflight, but they're not modern in any sense of the word. And the fact of the matter is, you know, since the 1970s, the Russians have not sent any probe into deep space successfully. They've had some failed Mars missions, and then just earlier this summer they attempted to land on the moon with the Luna 25 probe, and they were unsuccessful at crashing into the moon, which really provided, I think, a striking contrast. India comes along a couple of weeks later and successfully lands on the moon, kind of saying that, you know, India can now do something in space pretty significant that Russia has lost the capability to do.
Let's talk about international cooperation. I mean, Russia had up till, I think, fairly recently been able to cooperate with Western Europe and with the United States. That seems to have run into trouble, especially with the invasion of Ukraine. Who is and who isn't going in alone? Who's playing well with others to try to combine efforts?
Yeah, so the Russian space program had pretty deep ties, not just with NASA and the International Space Station, but certainly with the European space industry. Europe launched a lot of their Soyuz rockets from Europe's own spaceport, and then they also had this joint mission to go to Mars, where Russia was basically building a lander on a spacecraft that was built by Europe that was going to go to Mars, and so they were going to have an opportunity to have a successful mission to Mars. A lot of that cooperation broke down, and so now it's just basically a bare bones cooperation between NASA and Russia and Europe on the International Space Station and nothing else. And all of that is due to the war in Ukraine. It was really the European Space Agency backed away very quickly. And so now, you know, if we step back and look at the moon, you have two kind of competing efforts to send humans to the moon. You've got NASA with its Artemis program, and then the Europeans, many of the European countries are going along with that, and other countries around the world. And then you have China and its effort to go to the moon by 2030 or the mid-2030s, and actually Russia has signed on to the Chinese effort, and so that cooperation has kind of shifted, especially in light of the Ukraine war.
Now, there's been arguments about, you know, should putting people back on the moon be a goal? How much of this, whether it's China or the U.S. and allies, is it, yeah, there's going to be genuine scientific value to putting people on the moon versus the symbolic milestone of it?
So, you know, it was all about geopolitics back in the 1960s. It was basically, is capitalism supreme or is communism supreme? And there's definitely a major geopolitical element of this current race between the United States and China. I think both nations see, you know, leading these international coalitions is very important. But things have changed, right? And probably the biggest change, certainly for the United States, has been the rise of the commercial space industry. So it's not just about, you know, putting flags and footprints on the moon. It's really trying to lay down the ground for a sustainable operation, so long-term operation. So not just going there a few times and stopping, but actually going there and staying there and ultimately harvesting resources on the moon and potentially asteroids as well. And so there are private companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and other companies that are playing an important role as part of NASA's program. And the thought is that if NASA goes first, then it will sort of pave the way for commercial activity to follow, much like the Transcontinental Railroad sort of did in the United States, you know, 150 or 200 years ago, to kind of open up the West to settlers and commercial activity. That's a very broad metaphor. I don't know if that's what's going to happen, but that's kind of big picture the goal.
We're talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at recent developments in space exploration, including the latest efforts to land probes on the South Pole of the Moon. Coming up, we'll look more at the private companies here in the U.S. getting in the game, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you lived through the Cold War era space race, what do you remember about that time? Did you watch the moon landing back in 1969? What are you thinking now as you watch the newest kind of space race? What should the priorities be, if any? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions, or you can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica. We're talking to him about the latest from space, including India's successful Chandrayaan-3 mission to the South Pole, or near the South Pole, of the Moon, and the state of the broader space industry. We're going to check out the latest from private companies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest? Do you want the United States to prioritize getting into space, maybe getting people on the moon, more probes to Mars? What, if anything, do you want to see as priority number one? If commercial space flight, orbital flight, whatever, got inexpensive enough, would you go? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric, I want to talk about the newest rounds of private companies getting into the space industry. Now, there's always been some level of public-private partnership going on here. Companies like Northrop, I think, and Boeing and whatever, designing our older spacecraft. What companies are at the top of your list right now with the most promising developments?
Well, I think you would have to put SpaceX at the top of the list in terms of accomplishments. You know, they're the ones that they're up to launch as many as 100 rockets this year. They're going to send 3/4 of all mass sent to space this year will be launched by a single company. That's not like the United States, that's just SpaceX. And that you add up all the rest of the countries in the US and Europe and China and India. And so they're the ones doing the most interesting things, but there's a lot of other commercial activity behind SpaceX coming along as well. And so it's, you know, what NASA has really done over the last 15 or 20 years is stimulate this vibrant commercial space industry, which is really kind of giving this country its edge as it looks out in the 2020s and 2030s and wants to compete with China in space.
What are some of the companies on the list, maybe far behind SpaceX, but trying to emerge?
And you've got companies doing all sorts of different things. Like there's a company called Astroscale, which is trying to build satellites and spacecraft that can go out and take care of space junk in low Earth orbit, because there's a lot of old derelict satellites and pieces of rockets and debris up there that we could try to clean up that orbit. You've got a company like OrbitFab, which wants to build refineries in space, and so they could take water launched from Earth or collected on the moon and produce hydrogen peroxide or other things that other companies and customers might want. Blue Origin, the company owned by Jeff Bezos, is trying to build a completely reusable transportation system between the Earth and the moon that would refuel with liquid hydrogen. And so there's just lots of innovative ideas happening. It's kind of a wild, wild west in terms of financing. You know, a lot of these space companies went public over the last couple of years with this special purpose acquisition company, or SPACs. And they've not performed financially very well, so the stocks have taken a beating. And so, you know, we're sort of at a tipping point moment where we may see this industry really explode, or it may take a step back.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rod is with us in La Crosse. Rod, hi.
Yes, hello. I just wondering, once they sit there and get up there and they get on the moon, and do they all start grabbing land like they did in America from the Native Americans? That, I mean, they say, well, this is my part. And then they said, go to Mars and sit there and start grabbing land there too. I mean, this country has been so greedy anyhow, the way it's been, no matter who you are, you know, humans are the worst people on the planet. I mean, animals sit there and they're far better than humans.
Rod, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, as I understand it, Eric, there is a treaty, an agreement that no one country will start marking off territory claimed to parts of the moon's surface. Is there a thought that once we actually start going there, we'll observe that?
So that's a great question. You know, I think it probably is going to work somewhat like it does in Antarctica, where countries can have outposts and bases, but no one owns any of the land in Antarctica. But that is certainly going to be a territorial dispute or potentially an issue at the South Pole, which is, you know, we're talking about tens to maybe hundreds of miles of sort of land, not a huge area. Sort of at the South Pole that's really of interest, where these permanently shadowed regions are in the craters. So that is potentially something that could be disputed. And then also the commercial companies, you know, we're trying to get some assurances from the United States that, hey, you know, if I went to the moon and spent all of this money harvesting these resources, can I really resell those resources? Because, you know, they're not going to own the territory that they're on either. So the Outer Space Treaty is now 50 years old. It nominally sets up the rules of the law, which says no one can own this land, but it kind of may be the sort of thing where, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law once people get there. It's something really to watch over the next 5 to 10 years. The caller raises a great point.
Rod, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Eric, you mentioned earlier the Artemis mission, the goal over the next few years to work back to landing people on the moon, led by the U.S. with a bunch of partners. Along with that is this diplomatic effort called the Artemis Accords. As you mentioned, European countries, I think I saw Saudi Arabia, Rwanda, South Korea, Japan, others, India signed onto it, not Russia and China, but it sets out all these pretty ambitious goals on cooperation and sharing all the science and not claiming land. Is this just, you know, diplomatic paperwork, or is there something really there to these Artemis Accords?
I think there's something really there. You know, about 30 countries have signed on, and these basically set the rules of the road by which NASA and its partners are going to explore the moon. And so that means like the sharing of scientific data, you know, just kind of transparency, you know, operating out in the open, that kind of thing. It's a pretty benevolent way of exploration. It says, hey, we're going to do this, and we think these are the best practices, you know, for exploring the moon in the 21st century, and we'd like you to come along. And so you've got, like I said, you've got the Artemis Accords and the nations that are sort of signed up for that. And the incentive there, of course, is if you give some money, then potentially you could have an astronaut on the surface of the moon in 10 or 15 years. And so we're likely to see that. We've already seen that with China, you know, or excuse me, with Canada. There will be an astronaut flying around the moon on the Artemis II mission in just a couple of years. And in the future, we're going to see European and Japanese astronauts on the surface of the moon. And then, as you said, China and Russia and some other countries that have signed up with them, like Venezuela, are going to go their own way.
Talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at the latest news in space exploration. Eric, you mentioned, you know, we've got these private companies in the U.S., but a lot of them driven by NASA and federal government funding incentives. I know over the years there have been arguments, you know, where do we direct our money? Moon, Mars, people, unmanned probes, telescopes, satellites, whatever. What do you see as the latest priorities coming out of NASA that are driving some of this?
So it's really interesting. If you look at public survey after public survey, the top two priorities you get from the public are protecting the Earth from asteroids. So like, you know, being able to deflect a killer asteroid and finding them before they can hit Earth. And the other one is Earth science, understanding and studying our planet. And actually, if you look down the list, you have to go pretty far down before you find human exploration of the moon and Mars. You know, NASA is doing a lot of things for Earth science and is doing some things for planetary science, but the majority of its budget is spent on human exploration. And there for a long time, there was a debate about, well, should we go back to the moon or should we go straight to Mars? And I think what we've really seen with this Artemis program, and what I like as someone who's followed the space industry for a long time, is that it does have a pretty coherent plan. It says, look, we're going to go back to the moon. It's something we can achieve within the next 5 to 10 years. And we're going to learn how to live there and work there and get the tools and strategies we need eventually to have a program to go on to Mars. And so I think the Artemis program is pretty good in concept, but we're certainly spending a lot of money on it, and as opposed to Earth science and asteroid defense.
I want to visit Mars for a moment. We've got rovers, Eric, that seem to keep outlasting their expected lifespan. I think I read a piece you wrote about the helicopter on Mars that was supposed to do 5 missions. It's done dozens, and it recovered from an unplanned landing. What do we have on the surface of Mars that you're watching right now?
Well, we've got 2 rovers, Perseverance and Curiosity. Curiosity has been there about a decade, and Perseverance for several years less. And then the helicopter has been flying along with Perseverance. Got a couple orbiters flying around the planet. And then, you know, there's China has a rover on Mars. It's active as well. And, you know, NASA's working on a mission to go to Mars and return some samples from there to study in Earth laboratories. So there's a lot going on Mars scientifically, but there is the stated goal by NASA and private companies like Elon Musk and SpaceX to send humans to Mars, you know, within the next 15 to 20 years. I'm not convinced that's feasible, but that's certainly something they're working toward.
And do you have your eyes elsewhere in the solar system? I think we mostly talk about, well, the Earth, of course, the moon and Mars. What else is going on in our neighborhood?
So there's some really exciting missions that are coming up. Next year, NASA is going to launch a probe to the Jupiter's moon Europa, which is entirely covered in ice. But it's believed to be, there's believed to be a huge ocean underneath the ice on Europa. There's more water on Europa than it exists on all the oceans here on Earth. And so that probe is going to go and fly by Europa more than 2 dozen times later this decade and return some fantastic data. And then there's another mission. It's going to Titan, which is a moon around Saturn, which has on its surface seas of liquid methane. Fascinating place. And we're going to go there and actually fly a helicopter-like object called Dragonfly around and get all kinds of information about the moons. And so the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are quite fascinating. We're finally starting to send dedicated probes there, and that's something I'm very excited about.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica. He was with us to talk about recent developments in space exploration, including India's recent successful landing near the South Pole of the Moon. You can follow Eric's reporting, a lot of great information, up-to-date information on the latest rocket technology as well, at arstechnica.com.